Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Allen Brim.
Government name again. And we are back with Scene 35 again, Death of Titanic Part 2. And we have another special guest with us today because, you know, we're getting into very, very big scenes here that I think call for an extra voice in the mix, in the conversation, to really break this stuff down. So with us today, we have Pablo Ohana, who is joining us from New York, but he is from the UK. And yeah, so hello, Pablo, how are you?
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm great. Yeah, I actually, everywhere I've been in New York, everyone's just been saying that I'm like a character out of Downton Abbey, which is, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's like, I think it's like the one English show that you guys have in America. And
stuff. That or Harry Potter.
Are you from England itself?
Yeah, so I'm from the north of England, a place called Manchester.
Okay.
It rains a lot. That's kind of the main thing about that.
I've heard. Yeah, so before we started recording, we were trying to figure out exactly how we had gotten in contact before. And I was like, hold that thought, wait till we record. So this could be part of the origin story. So I believe, yes, you were saying it was around the time of the 25th anniversary re-release. You were super into the box office for that. You were keeping tabs and you shared a lot of them.
Yeah, so I don't know why I find the box office fascinating. I think it's because, so my background is PR and marketing. So I've always had a fascination about what markets, what doesn't, what works, what doesn't. And the funny thing about Titanic is just that it never stops selling, right? So it just sells and sells and sells and sells. And so I was really interested in the box office because obviously it's its third kind of major release. And from the estimations that I could work out, it takes it to the highest grossing, the 25th anniversary takes it to the highest grossing, adjusted film of all time. The thing that I thought was interesting about that was that people love this idea that, like, Titanic is just fueled by, like, 13-year-old teen girls, and, like, this kind of drives me mad. But I just don't think you make that much money and sell that many tickets without a few other people in the audience. But there is something that no other film has managed to do with its box office runs, both in 97 and 2012. And I worked in a cinema when it was re-released in 2012, and it was mad. Like, I love Titanic. And at the time, like, my, when you worked at the cinema, you got like your name, and then underneath it was your favorite film. I don't know why, but like, for some reason I changed it. I got a new badge that changed from Titanic to Titanic 3D. I don't know why I thought that was really necessary to like differentiate between the two. But even the 2012 re-release was just a phenomenal box office. Like, films today would die to get the kind of run.
Right, like 300 million worldwide, I think it was.
350. It was like 353 or something. But like, it's just, yeah. So there's something about that I just find endlessly fascinating, because it's sort of, you know, people, as I say, people love to kind of talk it down. But I mean, the facts speak for themselves, in my opinion. So there was a really interesting moment in the 2012 re-release of Titanic where I went with my best friend Beth. In 2012, when we went to see it, you know, we were teenagers, and so we kind of associated with the Jack and Rose thing, and, you know, I just loved the film and I loved the spectacle of it, and I'd never seen it on a big screen before, so the first time I saw it on a big screen was just like, I actually cried. just at seeing it, like, nothing to do with the film, just like, oh my God, it's on a big screen. But then last year, we went back for the 25th anniversary. And what I thought was really fascinating is that, I guess you probably do a similar thing, Brittany, is like when you're watching Titanic with someone, you're like, what are they reacting to? Like, what are the things, you know? But this time, what got her was the mother at the stern with the son, because my friend Beth now has had a kid about a year ago. So she now really gets that bit. So I actually audibly heard her go like, oh my God, like at that bit. That's what's really interesting about the re-release, is that you kind of have either that new generation that get to see it for the first time, or for the first time on the big screen, or people who have a completely different outlook on life now, and what maybe got them in 97 or 2012, or when they saw it on VHS or DVD or whatever, something completely different gets them now. Something else is what you kind of go, oh God. And again, that's just, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating about this film is it just never stops managing no. to...
yeah.
So how old were you when it originally came out in 97?
I would have been like 3, so I was born in 94.
Okay. So when was the first time you watched Titanic?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same thing. I'm very curious to hear the whole origin story and yeah.
So it's really funny because when you reached out to me, Brittany, and was like, can you do this scene? I was like, oh my God, this is the first... This was my entry point to Titanic. So okay. When I was... it was Millennium New Year's Eve and me and my best friend, Patrick, who were just... terrors together. Everyone that ever looked after us was like, oh my God, never give me those two people again. And so Millennium New Year's Eve, my friend's mum just had enough of us. She just was like, just shoved us in front of a TV and she was like, just watch this, and just switched on the TV, and it happened to be that shot of Titanic just before the lights kind of flicker out, and I just was like completely gripped. And it's funny because my friend's mum, Anne, who I'm obviously really good friends with now, and she's kind of like the second mum in my life, you know, that kind of figure. Like, she's always been there, and she had not seen Titanic until I was like, right, it's back in cinemas for its 25th anniversary. You've got to come and see it. So we had this quite nice, or what I thought was quite a nice sort of full circle moment where she introduced it to me when I was 6 years old and had this huge impact on me and really... directed an awful lot of my life, actually. So much of my life has been dictated to by this film. And then I finally took her back to see it in IMAX 3D this 25th anniversary. Amazing. But that was my entry point to Titanic, that exact shot of it.
And it's funny that you got so roped in just not knowing the backstory of Jack and Rose and just literally just mesmerized by what was happening on screen and the tragedy mixed with all this other stuff.
It's so impactful. And I think, I mean, I've heard you talk about this both before, but when you see it in a cinema, and obviously I was seeing it on TV, but I was very young, and when you see it in the cinema, it is, I think you forget how impactful it is, actually. It is like a proper big screen blockbuster. Mm. I don't think it's that surprising that you do get pulled into it like that. I mean, there was like a whole lot of things that came after that. So, for example, we discovered that it sank on my birthday, so my birthday is the 14th of April. We then discovered that my 18th birthday would be 100 years to the day that it sank. Like, all these, so there were then kind of weird things that sort of happened afterwards, and then I got into the ship and I moved to Belfast. I worked at Titanic Belfast, the Titanic exhibition. So it very quickly kind of consumed my life.
When did you first watch it straight through?
So I actually don't remember when I watched it all the way through, because what I remember, my next memory of Titanic is my dad used to get me and my brother VHS tape, like blank ones, for Christmas.
Have fun.
Yeah. Really, really great presents. I came back from Anne's house. He said, oh, I've got a surprise for you. And I was like, what? And he was like, Titanic was on TV and I recorded it. But again, had only got the second half of it. So I don't quite remember when I fully sat down and watched the whole thing. And I think that maybe because I remember so clearly the first time I saw it in the cinema, and that almost became like the first time I saw it, because it was just...
Right.
And then you see it in IMAX or like Dolby.
Pablo, are you familiar with the Titanic Distillery in Belfast?
Yes, my friend works there.
Oh, really? Oh, that's so cool. I want to go there.
I meant to say to you, because I know you'll find this very exciting, that obviously I used to work at Titanic Belfast, which I think there's like a weird like thing between Titanic Belfast and the Titanic in America, because like they all claim to be like the world's largest. But I have just booked to go to Pigeon Forge Titanic. Hey! But I want to give a shout out to Titanic Belfast, because I did work there, and Titanic Belfast is where it was built. So I feel like everyone should go there at least.
Yes, definitely. No, I mean, yeah, if you have the opportunity to go to one over the other, definitely go to the Belfast one, because that is like the OG. And you can go to the distillery. Shout out to Titanic Distillery.
And you can go to Nomadic as well. And you can go to the drawing offices. You can go to the dry dock. I mean, honestly, if you like Titanic, you could. Belfast is... Yeah. That's all there is.
It's a whole trip, yeah.
So, I will say, I love hearing the different Titanic origin stories on the podcast because I say a lot, there's just so much overlap. Mm. And it's so amazing how this movie, it's not just our favorite movie for, you know, the people who come on here. It like changed our lives. It shaped our lives. It had such a big thing to do with us forever. And that's just something, again, that is fascinating, really, about
the movie. That is the thing about Titanic, though, right? Is that it doesn't just have, like, immeasurable success, although it does. And it doesn't just have, like, almost unsurpassed popularity, although it does. Like, when people talk about Titanic, it's, like, really genuine. It's really, like, heartfelt enthusiasm. I mean, it's so rare that someone goes, you know, Titanic, and people go, meh. Like, most people go, oh god, like, I remember exactly where I was, or I remember this scene, or it's my favorite film, or, I mean, in fact, like, I just moved to New York, and I got a personal trainer here, and I was in a session with him, and I was, like, transferring the money to pay him, and I was using this app where you also send a GIF with the app, with the money, and I typed in Titanic, and one of the first ones that came up was Jack and Rose dancing, where the camera, like, is on their feet, and I was like, oh, this is perfect, because we've just done leg day. So I sent that to him, and then the next day, or the next time I saw him, he was like, oh, thanks, yeah, I got the money. But by the way, how did you know? And I was like, how did I know what? And he was like, the Titanic was my favorite film. And I was like, what? And this is a guy, who's like straight, like gym bro, like late 20s, trains every day, listens, like DJs in his spare time. He is not, you know, the 13-year-old girl that like critics claim the entire film success is based on. It just never, you know, you were saying, Brittany, like, it's always somewhere. Titanic is always somewhere. And I was just like, I did not expect my PT's favorite film to be Titanic.
Amazing.
And by the way, it took Gone with the Wind several re-releases to get to its current box office gross. And also, there were like, when it first came out, there weren't four movies coming out every week and all that stuff. And yeah, to me, the most impressive accomplishment is Titanic's box office.
And that it's like one of the only movies from the 20th century still in the top.
That actually is one of the most impressive things about it, is that when you look at films, they're all like post 2000, like often post 2010, actually.
And they're franchises.
Yep. Yes.
Connected. There's merchandise.
You know, you find yourself, I mean, you guys probably have the same thing, but you find yourself like arguing and debating about Titanic and films like all the time. And one of the things that I find really funny is that people will say like, oh, I don't like Titanic or whatever. And I'm like, well, it's fine if you don't like it as a film, but you simply, in my opinion, can't argue it's not a good film. There are some films, your E.T.'s, you know, your Billy Elliot's, your Clockwork Oranges, your Jaws, your Titanic's, which are just good films. And you might not like them. That's your opinion. You're allowed to not like particular films.
Yeah.
But there are some films that are just like, they are well made. The story is good. The production is good. The graphics are good. You know, that is reflected, right? Your Jaws, E.T., Titanic, all these films are there for a reason, because they are universally just a good film.
Which, again, is crazy that what you said is probably a controversial statement in certain circles, which is like, how?
I don't understand it. James Cameron said something once, which I think really kind of hit the nail on the head, which is, I think Titanic just became too big, made too much money, won too much, just became so big. It's too much. I can't be around that all the time. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel the same about Avatar. So, you know, it's funny.
People Avatar goes through the cycles too, where it's like, it was really good, and then it was overrated, and then underrated, and then overrated, and then underrated. So,
but Avatar is just like CGI from start to finish. And it's just not like, for me, there's not like the heart and the craft that you see in Titanic. Do you know what I mean? So I'm getting really like enraged about this.
Yeah, Titanic's better than Avatar for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, I think it's about time to jump into the scene.
Let's do it.
So, the scene picks up right after Ismay turns away from the wreck, and we cut into the interior of the ship where we see the guys working. I don't even know what this room would be called. It's part of the engine room. Like,
I assumed it was just the engine. Or I guess, or
because it looks like they're talking about the breakers, so it's like somewhere where the electricity is stored, or you know, you hear them shout, "Keep those breakers in, keep them in." And now they're at a crazy angle, so they're struggling to get to where they need to go. And I'm pretty sure I feel like I read somewhere that they're playing that up, like it's not super tilted in this.
There's even some point where his gravity looks different than what the tilt is. So I assume it's probably, I'm assuming it's tilted slightly, but there's no, yeah, I don't think there's any way there's like a 20% grade on that. But
this man goes over to, well, because I know a lot of people speak about how, a lot of people were working in the ship like tirelessly to keep the lights burning, to keep it from listing or whatever, to keep it from tilting, onto its side and stuff like that, that a lot of people don't really notice or talk about.
And it might have been just a reminder that, look, even though, because we're about to see obviously the entire ship finally go under ultimately, so it's maybe just one last reminder that these people are in there.
It's what James Cameron does very well in this film, actually. Is, people give him a lot of shtick for, this tiny little bit isn't quite right, but what he does very well is kind of capturing the moment of that, that particular moment of that particular night. And I think there, like, it is well known that people, as you say, Brittany, like, people really worked until the last second to keep the lights on, to keep the electricity going, to send, the two Marconi wireless operators went until literally the water was around their feet. And so I think whether this is historically accurate or not, I think probably embodies that sort of, we go right until we possibly can to, because the second the lights go out, no one's seen that ship. So the longer the lights are on, the more chance people have of seeing it, I guess, is my...
Yeah.
No, yeah, that's a perfectly valid thing, yeah. So, of course, as soon as he touches the breakers or whatever it was that he was reaching for, there's a little bit of an electrocution that happens there. Very, very dramatic, sparks flying. And then we get that incredible shot of the ship at the angle in the water and the lights just flickering out.
That shot is...
it's so good.
Phenomenal. I mean, like, genuinely that... I mean, maybe because that was, this is my entry point, but that shot of the lights flickering going out is just, like, chilling.
Yes.
It's so horrifying to see.
Like, the amount of times I wrote "so good" in my notes for this scene is crazy.
Make sure you highlight them too when you edit.
Yeah, so many shots. I'm just like, so good.
and even though there's a bunch of CGI that's about to happen, which, by the way, looks insanely good for 1997, despite what anybody says, still the framing and the staging of everything is immaculate here. I mean, he didn't just lean on CGI like a lot of people do now, but he legitimately made sure that everything was really well shot.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, one of the things that works really well in this scene, I mean, across all the sinking scenes, but particularly this one as the breakup happens, is that they never use the same sort of trick twice. So you kind of watch something and you're like, oh, wait, what is that? And you can never quite figure out which, I mean, most people just watch the film and enjoy it. Like, very few people sit here and analyze it to the depth that we are. But it's almost impossible, really, unless you really sit down and analyze, like, frame by frame. It's so hard to know which bit is, like, miniatures, which is CGI, which is, that like, the actual ship that they basically built, or the poop deck. Like, it's genuinely really impressive, I think. I mean, even considering it was 26, 7 years on, and it still looks incredible.
It does.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I said, still looks amazing, looks incredible. And I said, as soon as the lights cut out, the groans and creaking of the ship increase and it picks up and the screams become louder and something is happening, It cuts into that closer shot of, like, right at the waterline or, like, the surface. And you can see the ship start to bulge. And it's like, that always was weird to me. I'm like, is that CGI? Because it kind of looks it. I can't tell if that was, like,
I think
one of the models that they had breaking.
I think it's a model. But, I noticed this recently, is that if you look on, like, every bit of that ship, everything is breaking. So if you even look at, like, the portholes individually smash, like, at different times, like, shatter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The attention to detail in that one scene is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, the motion-captured people, or not even motion-captured people. I think it's, like, green-screen people as well that they just, like, put in to, like, jump out of some of the windows right there near the surface line.
Yeah.
I was very confused, though, when they show the overhead shot of when it starts to break. They didn't break that giant set, but I think James Cameron did say that they had like a full-scale part of the ship that was meant to tear apart. That is maybe what this shot was.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like a massive model, because I just got the 4K Blu-ray, which they released like a month or so ago,
mm-hmm.
and I was watching all behind the scenes again, and I'm pretty sure that that is like a massive model, which they just split over and over again, because they had like tons of different models, and one of them was designed to just cut basically at exactly that point. And that's what it means. Like, it's quite impressive that like that actually just looks like a ship's plinking too. Like, you can't tell that that has been filmed on some sort of model.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this whole scene just shows like what a fine line there is between horror and tragedy, because, you know, we talked about it in our last scene, how like some of it is kind of like with the guy falling and then hitting his head on, what was it, the propeller.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about how, like, you know, that could be seen as, like, controversial. Like, is it too schlocky or is it realistic? But I think this scene is a better indicator of how well James Cameron handles the balance between those two things. Because, I mean, obviously, in this scene, I didn't think any of it was played for, like, shock and awe. I think all of it was very austere to the subject matter.
Yeah,
personally.
Well, I actually think he balances that fine line of cinematic drama and taste quite well. And there are definitely points in this film where that doesn't happen. And like, I know you guys have discussed the kind of Murdoch, you know, thing, which I also, you know, it really is like, yeah. It's basically the only thing that I'm like, could have just made that anyone and then that would have been great. But in this, in these sinking scenes, like, it doesn't feel like there is this kind of like, okay, let's just like slam it in your face for no reason.
Yeah.
Everything that happens, you know, you're talking about the groaning there. Like, for me, it's like, you know, Titanic is the main character in this film, and you're seeing this ship, you're seeing the main character die in front of you, and it's like a dying monster, right? So you're talking about like that kind of horror, drama, tragedy, like, this is like a massive monster that is groaning and dying in front of you. You know, James Cameron portrays that so well that, you know, when I worked at Titanic Belfast, people would often ask how Titanic sank. And it's really hard to explain. And like, the Titanic Belfast galleries were quite reserved in the sinking galleries. And I would often say, listen, watch the film, because, okay, it's not like pitch perfect, but in terms of capturing the horror and the violence of that night, you're not going to see anything better than that, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess that must be the bigger model where, like, we see Lovejoy and a couple other people running around right there as it starts to break. Because I was like, there's no way. Are they, like, green screened on? I was like, because that just looks incredible. That looks like they're on the ship as it's breaking right at the tear, you know?
And all the stunt work here is really impressive, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, like you said, you can't tell what is an effect and what is they're actually, I mean, obviously no one's actually falling like that from that far, but 1997, I mean, and it was made before, it's like, it's insane how well this holds up compared to like modern
mm-hmm.
CGI.
Yeah, because we've said it many times, you know, it was just used sparingly to do what they couldn't do mm-hmm. with practical effects.
Yeah,
as I said before, like that kind of like chopping and changing, as you say, like you're like, is that a model? Oh no, wait, that must be. And like even like people like us who've seen the behind the scenes are like, I remember seeing that bit, but like that still looks ridiculously good. Like, even though I know exactly how they're doing that, you know, the life jackets with the balls on and like the wires and you're still like, but I still can't quite figure out like how this is happening. You know?
Yeah.
I'm sure CGI, if you're a filmmaker, is kind of an addiction where it's like you use it at first for necessity and then you're like, whoa, this is pretty cool. Start playing with it more. And then before you know it, you have Avatar.
You have the Star Wars prequels before you know
the Star
it.
Wars. Yeah, that's a better example, right? George Lucas. But this is really good even for somebody who has who had at that point used CGI or some form of CGI for a long time. By 1997, he'd probably used it in about three or four films. I'm guessing at this point.
I don't know if this is the right time to bring this up, but like the thing that is it struck me recently, like, you guys kept talking about, like, setups and payoffs in this film. And this isn't exactly that, but the reason that all of this stuff works so well, so the fact that you can't, you know, you're watching this, like, destruction, is because you have lived with this ship, right? So you've been on it with Jack and Rose, and you've seen her in all the glory. You've seen the flying scene, which, by the way, I know this is not the flying scene. Flying scene. The greatest scene in cinema history. No, I'm not... I don't want to hear a debate on it. That scene is just... What an... Yeah. Original...
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty
iconic.
I just... It's beyond iconic. It is just like... How he came up with that...
Mm-hmm.
Genius. But anyway, the point is that, like, all the kind of, you know, King of the World flying, all those sorts of things, it celebrates Titanic so much. So when you see this, you're seeing, you know, Titanic ripped from limb to limb work because of that. They're so much more impactful. And all this, like, you know, the CGI and all the miniatures we're talking about and things, you almost can't kind of bring yourself to figure out what's going on, because you're also just like, oh my God, this is horrendous. Like, this incredible ship that we've lived on for the last 3 days or 3 hours is being destroyed in front of you. And I think that that's, like I said, it's not quite a setup and payoff, but, you know, the number of times people say, oh, I could do without the romance. Well, no, you need that time to really fall in love with the ship. And then that's why this is so horrible to watch.
Yeah.
It's a macro payoff. Yeah. You could say even, yeah.
Hmm.
Good point.
I know. And speaking of setups and payoffs, the shot of Lovejoy was going to be another callback to that deleted scene.
I was so confused the first time I saw this. I was like, why are we focusing on this, like, random Lovejoy character? And why is he covered in blood? Like, the first time, I just didn't get it at all until I saw the deleted scene.
Yeah, see, it's funny. In my notes, I said, I never questioned it. I was just like, they're just showing us that this is where Lovejoy is on the ship, and this is obviously how he's gonna die, I guess. You know, he's right at the split. And as for the blood, I was like, well, I mean, look at everything that's going on, you know what I mean? I was like, odds are, yeah, maybe something hit him in his head and now he's bleeding. Like, it's been a minute since we last saw him, you know? Anything could have happened between then and now. So I never really questioned it, but...
I think that makes more sense than the, like, trauma that I put myself through of being like, what's up? Like, what's going on? I should just come to the conclusion that you did.
I'm like, this is a very dangerous situation. I'm sure maybe even people could be a little bloody from God knows what, you know? Yeah, so obviously he looks shocked at this happening, and I was like, in my notes, I just wrote karma for his character, at least, that he ends up right there. We end up seeing a brief shot of part of the interior collapsing, which looks really great.
That is a miniature. That's the miniature, the first class, yeah, is incredible.
Again, we've mentioned it, but, like, the porthole rings, that's where they really come, like, popping off right towards the camera.
Did you see it in Dolby Atmos in its rewind?
Yes.
When those portholes, like, flip off, there is that this kind of, like, like, this kind of, like, whipping noise. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but I really, really hear it for some reason.
Mm-hmm. It's like,
yeah,
it makes like a noise like that, kind of, yeah.
The 3D conversion, I don't know if you guys are planning to talk about this, but the 3D conversion is mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's really great, yeah. Especially in Dolby, it looked really great.
I mean, genius. That's all I have to say on it.
But yeah, the portholes, the sound and the visual of it was always very noticeable to me. So we see, I think it's just two men, but there's like some cuts they cut back and whatever, who fall right into the split. And I believe they're being pulled by some wires. You can see them being pulled by wires into it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the wires are removed in newer releases, but every time I watch it on whatever I have, now I can see those wires. So I'm sorry for ruining it.
You have just ruined it for me. I've never noticed that.
You can't notice it on VHS.
Because the quality's so bad.
Yeah. But it's like, it's so fast. Like, you're so into the moment, you don't. But like, if you just look, you can kind of see. And I hate pointing out things like that, because now I know that I'm ruining it for other people.
Wow.
Yeah, so of course the historians believe, and now James Cameron, I believe, thinks too, that, you know, the ship would have broken probably more underwater than above water, like we see in the movie. But obviously, we've said a million times, it's a movie. They're going to show us things. You know what I mean? Even if that's not perfectly accurate, you know, it's helpful to see it.
So would that have prevented it from going the top part from going flat again? Or would it, what would have happened?
Well, that is another thing that they tested relentlessly, where I think James Cameron came to the conclusion that you can't have the stern of the ship fall back level and go back up to 90 degrees. Both of those things can't happen. It has to be either or, I think.
Huh. Okay, so that part. Okay, interesting. I do, from a cinematic standpoint, I like that it went flat because, you know, we're talking about this as like a horror in a sense too. It is a sigh of relief on some level, but subconsciously, I think the if you're on there, you know it's not going to last, yeah. But it's an interesting sensation to watch it happen. All these, for like, you know, I don't know how long the sinking's been occurring for at this point, but for it to finally go flat again, you know, you have to be thinking, okay, we can breathe, like, what now? And then it goes down again. Like, I liked that, the beats there that happen. I thought it was super effective from just a traumatic standpoint, I guess.
Yeah, I think the historians said people thought, oh, it's gonna float. Like, I think they said, yeah, like, oh, it's back. Like, it's fine. It'll stay.
It's like encapsulating the horror of that night. And it's funny that working at Titanic Belfast, often, you know, people would say, what is the best Titanic film? And it's always debated, right? Like James Cameron's Titanic versus A Night to Remember, which is like the British sort of 1958 version of Titanic, which people, particularly critics, like to claim as the Titanic film. And I'm British, to be clear. just in case my Downton Abbey accent isn't giving it away. But the ship hits the iceberg in A Night to Remember, and it's like, oh no, oh gosh, oh blimey, oh, the ship is sinking. And it's like, there's no horror to it. The whole film is like, it's like melodramatic in a really understated way. And I think maybe James Cameron has kind of heightened things, but actually I think it captures what was probably the horror of that night. Okay, so we now know it couldn't have done both of those things as we've just discussed, but as Ethan said, like the cinematic impact of both of those things happening, I think just really hammers home how violent the sinking was. And I think it's kind of, to a modern audience, is important for them to be like, you know, to see that it didn't just slip beneath the surface. Like, it was horrible.
It was a process, yeah, for sure. An emotional process on top of a physical process.
Yep. And this is the first Titanic film to show it split in half. It has that distinction as well.
Yeah. But that shot is also just, like, stunning. Like, that
when
shot...
When it falls?
Well, the shot of it just standing there before it kind of... I mean, obviously, it's falling and it goes back up. Like, that shot of it is just, like, breathtaking. And it's not just, like, impressive, you know, from sort of CGI perspective and all the rest of it, but you get that sort of like 3 seconds, as you sort of said, Ethan, like, is there, like, is everything gonna be fine? But you get this sort of 3 seconds of just peace, relative peace,
deceptive peace. Yeah,
so you're talking about later when it goes up 90.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, like, if you hadn't had, you know, if you don't have that other bit, then you couldn't have had it then standing up later. And I think that is the, like, that whole sequence is just, okay, maybe it couldn't have all happened, but I think cinematically it's masterful.
Yeah.
Yep. So yes, as the stern starts to fall back level, and as it's falling, all I think about is everybody must be losing their stomachs.
Yeah.
In that moment. And I just, it makes me think of that pirate ship ride at carnivals and stuff. You know the ride I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The one that just goes back and forth, and every time you, like, you know, you drop your stomach. And I'm just like, oh, this is literally that. I just can't. People, you know, clinging for dear life.
Because how far are they falling from, essentially, right? Like,
yeah,
they're all the way up there and then it's going flat. They're falling, like, dozens of feet, probably.
The shot as well, where you, like, the camera sort of clings onto, in the foreground you have this kind of like extra guy, but in the background you've got Jack and Rose, and the camera kind of like follows them, and it sort of like pans down as the ship falls back into the water, is like really impactful. And you really get that sense of, you know, given that you're sitting in at home or in the cinema or whatever, you really get that sense of speed and the impact of that, because the camera kind of really follows them down so quickly, and it's really impressive.
I don't know, I was gonna say, I love that they show like an older man, just to show, like, there's like an older man and an older woman, you know, everyone's here clinging to life, you know.
Yeah.
And so as it goes down, obviously everyone's screaming, and then they cut back to show you that there are still people in the water underneath the ship as well as it falls down. And I mean, even that still looks great. Obviously, those people are green screened in, like, or it's, you know, all whatever, you know.
Obviously.
But I'm saying that it still looks pretty good.
Yeah, it does look really good.
And, you know, you feel so bad for the people underneath. And, you know, we've talked about it before that it would have been much darker in actuality. So if you think about being anybody who might have been under the ship, they didn't even know what was coming. Yeah. Like, it was just pitch black. And then... just, it is very horrifying to think of. Yeah, and, it really is. Like, there's two little people who, like, fall off the deck once it hits level and, like, the big splash happens. And then also, I wrote in my notes, like, the very dissonant score. As it's coming down.
It's very jarring, like that whole thing, which is presumably deliberate, but as you say, like all those kind of like clashing of sounds is deliberately quite like unsettling, and you're like visually and just audio, like everything is just horrible right now, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And credit to James Cameron, he doesn't try to make this poetic by any means, I don't think. Like everything, I mean, obviously the shots when, you know, they show the lifeboat looking back, you know, that has some of that in there, but how do you make poetry out of something like this or poignancy or anything like that? Like you have to just show it as chaos and dissonance and all this stuff. So
once the ship or once the stern does hit the water again, people lose their balance. And I, you know, always notice because they make a point to show it how Jack loses his grip on the railing and just sort of punches Rose in the face there. And she's just kind of like, oh, then they cut and they show the whole ship, you know, split in half and the smokestacks falling over. And so good. So good. But I really do love that little part of him sort of accidentally punching her in the face now. I used to not like it over the years, and I used to kind of not laugh, but I used to be like, oh my gosh, like it just, that seems so like, oh no, like Jack accidentally punched Rose, like, you know what I mean? But now, you know, having talked about in some previous scenes, like when Rose fell and then like the baker helped her up, you know, stuff like that, it's very imperfect. It's like showing you like the realities of the situation. Like this whole thing is not just going to happen perfectly. So just keeping some, just a small little bit like that in there of poor Jack hitting Rose in the face. It's like, this would happen.
But those little like moments are what keep it kind of, you know, we talked before about it not being unnecessarily dramatic. I think those moments of realism keep it kind of grounded in the, you know, this is just chaos. You know, it's not like a beautiful painting. Like this is just like unadulterated chaos, just drama and horror, and no one knows what's going on. And those moments of, you know, tripping up or falling or hitting or whatever it is, like build that kind of sense of just, listen, it's a free for all now. Like it's just quite literally every man for himself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as I said in my notes, I said, as Louis Bodine told us at the start of the movie, the bow and the stern section are still connected below the water. So the bow is now beginning to pull the stern up again. And, you know, again, that's very handy information for us to know. Because as we see later in this scene, Rose is asking, what's happening, Jack? Like, you know what I mean? Because like she does, why is the ship standing up like this? You know what I mean? It's like we would be asking the same questions if we didn't see that breakdown of the sinking at the beginning.
I would have loved to have Jack just explain it. Well, you see, underneath the water, they're still connected. And so it's pulling us down.
That's exactly why they didn't have him do that. Right. So now, as it starts to move back up again, I said the score, I mean, I didn't double check this, but it sounds very chromatic of like, da, 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 da. Like it's just very, like, it, I think it said it almost sounds like reverse Jaws. I don't know if I did this for this part or later. I think it might have been a little bit later when it was going down. Yeah. But like, the Jaws is a little do-do-do-do. It's a little chromatic thing, but this feels like just like at a higher tone and maybe even revert like do-do. Yeah, instead of do-do, it's the higher note down to the lower note instead.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, just made me think of that. So let's see. But yes, that it perfectly accentuates the like impending final plunge, obviously, but also the uncertainty that the passengers are experiencing as the stern is rising back up. It's like, you know, it's like, what is going on? Like, you know, no one knows what's happening. But obviously, as passengers begin to fall and slide down the deck again, and it starts to tip much faster due to the pull of the bow underneath, you know, Jack realizes we have to move and begins to try to start climbing over to the other side of the railing. The love theme kicks back in, and it has that like sweeping entrance to the theme with the right. And so he starts telling Rose, you know, give me your hand, I'll pull you over. And this is a total callback to when he saved her at this same exact spot physically on the ship or geographically. And he repeats some of the same lines again, like, I've gotcha, I won't let go, like, come on, I gotcha, like pulling her over to safety in a totally different way on the ship here. And I think I heard James Cameron say that he copy and pasted Jack's exact dialogue line from the You Jump, I Jump scene earlier in the movie with when he saves her from the suicide attempt. He claims to have just taken that audio and put it there of him saying, I gotcha, I won't let go. But it doesn't... I didn't check. I didn't like line them up right to make sure they were exactly the same. But they seem a little different to me.
He said he did that?
Yeah, maybe I made that up in my head, but I swear I feel like I heard him say that.
He's so meticulous in like everything. It just is so strange that he would just kind of phone it in with that audio.
No, he said that for a reason. Maybe it was in here. He said it for a reason because he really wanted to trigger that memory for us.
Ah, got it. Okay.
To be like, this is paralleling this moment.
It wasn't like he was just like, I don't feel like recording this again. I'm just going to copy and paste it.
Yeah, no. Here it is. I knew it was somewhere. It's in the annotated screenplay book.
Huh.
It says, this is a quote from Cameron, not letting go is a thematic element in the relationship between Jack and Rose from the moment they meet to the moment Jack dies. In post, I actually copied the voice track from scene 61 where Jack is pulling Rose back onto the ship after her suicide attempt. I've got you. I won't let go. And I copied it into this scene to make the strongest possible rhyming sequence.
So is it the exact same audio? So not Jack saying the same lines. It's actually just the audio from the suicide.
Yeah, I think, but like, I didn't, I probably should have tried to line the two up and make sure that they were exactly the same, because maybe he did take it from maybe a slightly different take.
Right.
I don't know.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so you see other passengers attempting to climb over and secure themselves as well, including the baker, Charles Jugan. And so now, as the ship is going vertical, like I said, Rose is, you know, asking, what's happening, Jack? And he says, I don't know. And I said, obviously she knows the ship is sinking, but she doesn't know why it's standing completely vertical. Like, you know what I mean? Because again, people in the YouTube comments, they do the quotes, what's happening, Jack? Oh, I don't know, Rose, the ship is sinking. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, excuse me. Obviously she knows that. She's asking, why is it happening like this?
I feel like the script between Jack and Rose is unfairly maligned, actually. People have, like, such beef with the script in Titanic. And I think a lot of it, like this, the ship is sinking, like, they don't know what the hell's going on. Like, why are you judging them for, like, you know, on the way down, I think she says again, like, what's happening? And he just keeps saying, I don't know, like, hold my hand, like, all this sort of stuff. I'm like, yeah, like, is that not what you'd be doing from the back of the ship that was sinking? Like, he's not like, hold on 1 second, let me just, like, test the air and, like, figure out, like, the mathematics of, like, the angle of the ship and, like, they have no idea what's going on. Like, give them a break. If they want to just basically say to each other that they don't know what the hell is going on, like, let him.
Yeah. So he says, I don't know. And then it becomes stationary at 90 degrees. That is that moment where it, like, the score kind of drops out except for like this little airy light choral thing. it's just kind of like, ooh, you do get like that moment to like breathe for a minute.
You get those amazing shots. It sort of does that shot where it pulls out and you see it just standing. And it's just incredible. Mm-hmm.
So good. I said in my notes, I said, this literally looks like it's a ship in the middle of the sea. Same once it does start to go down, it just looks incredible.
There's kind of this like sort of clunking noise as well. It's not someone hitting something. There's sort of this like sort of metal creaking clunk. And I don't know why. Again, this is just one of those really weird things that only like absolute tight like nuts like us would notice. But there's this sort of like metal clunk. And I think Jack then says like, you know, hold on or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but it's always stood out to me because it's that kind of like, even in that moment, there's just this like, just don't let go of anything. Like, we have no idea what's going on. And it really, I don't know why, but it's always added to that sense of just like complete chaos and not knowing what's happening in that moment.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else has ever noticed that.
I've totally noticed the clunk. Yeah. Especially now that you say it. Mm-hmm. And so I did say though, when they show from the side and you can see like for everybody who's on the back of the stern from the side, and Jack keeps looking over his shoulder, like down at the propellers or whatever he's looking at, how high they are. That is one like green screenshot or something that does not look very good. Like I don't know what it is about that.
I know which one you're talking about.
And I think they show it like twice.
That's probably the worst one, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is, if it's just like, because in Dolby it looked pretty good because the blacks are really strong on the screen in Dolby, so it kind of like irons out some of those, what do you call it? The leveling of the composited.
Like the contrast?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so, yeah, when it doesn't have that going for it, you can tell that the people, you know, the shot of everybody on the ship is lighter than the backdrop or vice versa, something like that. So like they really stand out. You can tell that it's something's going on there. And that always kind of stands out to me and bothers me just a little bit every time. I'm like, I don't know if they had to like green screen in the night sky behind them or something like that. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know. But something. And yeah, so right after that is when Jack says, hold on. And then we get another Jack, Rose. This back and forth of their name, for some reason, this one, if I could cut any of the Jack and Rose back and forth, I might cut this one.
You know, it's so funny. I never noticed this whole Jack and Rose thing. I never noticed it until you guys pointed it out, and I was like, how have I never picked up on that? Like, when they're down and they're running downstairs, it just feels totally natural because they're just shouting at each other.
I never really cared either, but I felt like it did become a very like notorious thing. I would see people leave comments about Titanic and they'd be like, what's the screenplay, 75 pages of Jack and Rose, like, whatever. I'm just like, you know, it's like, that's why it didn't win best screenplay.
All right, sorry, 11 Academy Awards wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so this one just feels a little bit unnecessary because they're just stuck together. Like, why are they saying each other's names again like that? And Jack's voice, like, quivers a lot. She's like, Jack, Rose. Like, it sounds very like he's acting there. That one's just kind of funny. But it's very soft in the mix, so it's not too bad. But when you notice it, it's just, why? Why do we have to have it again?
We'll never forget their names.
Nope. Yeah, so I said more passengers continue falling and hitting others on the way down. And like the piles of dummies as well, like all those people that are stacked up at the railings on the way down there. Oof.
The sounds.
Yes.
I remember like I did film studies at A-level, which is like kind of in between your high school and sort of university. I remember my film studies teacher saying that watch a scene and listen to it rather than like watch it. And there are some really great examples in Titanic of that. One of them is the scene where Rose jumps back on to the ship. Like the audio focus there is just amazing, like with the creaking of the davits and things. But here as well, you get that like those bodies hitting each other is so visceral. Like it's really like there's this like really horrible sort of like thumping as like, I mean, like as you say, they're dummies, but there's still that kind of just horrible, horrible sound, that like image of people just like hitting each other as they go down. It's just horrifying.
And I love as well, Yes, with everyone falling and hitting in this particular scene where they're like showing some of that, you can, and Jack and Rose are witnessing all of it from up there on the railing and, you know, freaking out a little bit, seeing all of this happen beneath them. You can hear a man shouting very loudly, like, help me, please. It's so sad. Like, everybody's
But it's also so much more noticeable in that moment, because you say you sort of get these sort of few seconds where it's just standing there, and it's this few seconds of, like, relative calm, and you just hear, like, say, those kind of little, like, help me's, or you hear, like, the sort of the creaking and the clunking and the bodies. Like, it allows you just to have a few seconds of, like, okay, like, this is going to be it. Like, this is going to be bad. And as I said before, like, Titanic is essentially the main character. And so you kind of know, like, this is your last chance. Like, this is the end of essentially, obviously have the end of the film with the dream and the heart of the ocean and things. But, like, this is the end of basically the main character of this film. And so it almost kind of gives you that moment to just take that in and be like, this is going to happen and it's going to be horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, too, it's interesting, too, when you talk about, when you think about the structure of the movie, because this is essentially, like, the climax, but then the emotional marquee tragedy, like, the emotional climax is twofold, because you get, obviously, when Jack dies later. So it's just interesting to see.
Well, it's kind of like, it's kind of, I always saw it as James Cameron kind of giving Titanic her final send-off, in that, like, as you say, you have the emotional moment of Jack dying, and then you have the kind of the dream slash death sequence, depending on where you sit on that. But, you know, this is kind of James Cameron, as I say, sort of being like, this is the end of this ship that you have come to know. And yes, obviously Jack and Rose are the two main characters, but it's that kind of, as you say, like, the climax of one of the biggest parts of this story. And I think all of the stuff around it that we've talked about, all the kind of like this, the music and the sounds and the, like, it's almost kind of just supporting that. Like, this is kind of his ending of that ship. I don't know, but it's always made me think in this moment, this is what it's been building up to. And of course, like, there is more to come, but like, this ending of the ship is the final kind of goodbye. And it's kind of, you would find it more sad if it wasn't so horrifying in the moment. You're so shocked by what you're seeing that you can't find it that emotional. And then obviously Jack dying is the emotional part.
The score is building just a little bit more, and then a little horn like accompanies Helga, who, that was just previously established. Rose looked over and recognized Helga, and I think her dad was with her too, just a little bit off camera. And yeah, so, you know, we're supposed to realize that this is Helga's end right now, just dangling from the railing until she can't hold on anymore and, you know, lets go and falls. And she screams a very horror-like scream as well when she falls. And Rose can only really watch. Yeah, I was really getting the horror vibes a lot more when I was taking my notes this time. Like, when Helga did that scream, I was like, that is out of a horror movie. But
I think the thing that's really noticeable there is you get that like horror scream, but then given how much we have seen and heard of other bodies, it's kind of funny that you then don't hear her body go anywhere. And maybe it was like one too much or whatever. And I know that, like I always say, one of the scenes that I was really, I was gonna say gutted, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but like I think it's a shame that was cut out, was Cora's death. Because it's just horrible. Like, it's absolutely horrible. But it's so impactful. And I know that I read some of it, was some discussion about it just being a little bit too much. And they wanted to keep it PG-13 in America, 12A in the UK, whatever, like, around that certificate. And they were just like, maybe that was just a bit too much. But I think it's funny that in that scene, you see so many of these, like, bodies hitting and you hear the sounds. And for some reason with hers, you just don't. You hear that scream and then that's kind of like, okay, that's enough, you know?
Yeah.
But I also, I don't know if, has it already happened yet, the shot where Rose looks at the...
That's about to happen right now.
Okay, yeah.
Yep, and I have it highlighted here. I said my favorite moment and potentially my favorite scene almost in the whole movie. I think I had talked about this...
Wait, what?
Oh my God, that's... This is quite big.
Yeah, I talked about this briefly many, many, many episodes ago. Someone asked what our favorite scenes were, and I was like, I don't know if I want to talk about them yet, but like, I guess I'll mention it. I love the moment where Rose and the baker look at each other. I love this. So Rose looks to her right and locks eyes with Charles Jugin, the baker, as I believe a cello, maybe, plays a very foreboding little quick line that's like, and like, that's like it. And while they're just looking at each other, and obviously this is the last few seconds before the real, legit final plunge begins, okay? There's something about that moment between them that I just love. Not only is it, once again, sort of mixing Jack and Rose with history directly again, because Charles Jugin was said to have been on the back of the stern there, and he wrote it down like an elevator like that, and, you know, everything. So I like the way that they're sort of tying her into that. But then also it's just these two completely different people. They've interacted a little bit throughout the sinking so far, but then, you know, here they are. They've found themselves at this place about to face imminent death, most likely, you know, and it's just, they just give each other this look like, well, here we go. There's so many different things that they could be saying with their eyes here.
I think the thing that always stood out to me there is that, like, in another life, I did sort of talent management with actors, and like, facial acting is actually quite hard, and their faces, both of them, is pitch perfect. Like, the horror on both of their faces is so palpable. Like, you can really feel when the camera cuts to the two of them, you can just see it all over their faces. They're just like, this is gonna be bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's gonna be bad. And I think it always stuck out for me that I'm so glad you mentioned it. I was like, is it coming? Because, like, it is, like, it's just those two faces are just like, if you were to capture on someone's face what that night was like, it really, really looks like that. And it's funny, like, it always stood out to me as well. It was just really impactful and great acting from them both.
Mm-hmm. And I also love how in the background you can hear more screaming at that moment when they're staring at each other. It's like a woman's voice now that's going, help! And I do have to say, though, it's amazing that you just spoke about how great the facial acting is and how, like, that's all you needed, right? There was originally a line here. Another deleted quote.
Let's go. Let's get it.
This would have ruined... Oh. Oh, these deleted lines. Oh, why are they so funny and awful? Why? Like, I don't understand. Rose and the baker were supposed to look at each other. I can't even say this with a straight face. Like, that's why it's not in there, because James Cameron was like, yeah, why would I ever write this? No one can say this. So the baker was supposed to look at Rose and say, hell of a night.
No. Serious?
I'm so serious.
Man. That would have just killed. Oh, man. That would have. That's like some Tommy Wiseau stuff right there. That's not
in
good.
In a sense, though, you kind of have to give props to James Cameron for knowing when to cut. Like, you know, there are so many things in this film where you're just, I mean, like, less said about the alternative ending, the better. But, like, there are so many things that almost makes, what makes Titanic's success so impressive is how it could have been so very different. Like, there are so many things.
That's what we say all the time.
You really could have made a different film.
Yep. In the screenplay for Charles Jugin, nodding a greeting, hell of a night.
That's amazing.
And the little thing says, Baker Jugin's line was deleted from the final film because it disrupted the suspense and horror of the scene. I'm like, you don't say.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome, though.
Does that mean they shot it, though?
I was just going to ask that. Yeah, did they, was it in there then? And then they took it out?
No.
Because I've definitely never seen that in the deleted scenes or anything like that. It's definitely not on.
Yeah. So it's in the annotated screenplay, though?
Mm-hmm.
That line. Hmm.
I just couldn't believe that when I read it. I said, oh, there's another terrible deleted line to mention.
He emptied the trash after that one. After that cut. He's like, no one's ever seen this. That's pretty good, though.
He emptied the trash.
I do like how it, for me, it played like, okay, Jack and Rose are our main characters, and she's looking over at this guy who, you know, is at the very most, you know, a minor character, I guess. it kind of just weighs them together, like, to the, as an audience, like, you see these two main characters and you see this guy who is just, you know, the baker on the ship, right? Yeah. I don't know. I like that it kind of weighed these two people as, like, you know,
equals.
Equals as they're sinking down. This guy is about to go down just as Rose and Jack are about to go down. So
exactly.
I like that.
There is that kind of, like, throughout the film, it's a peppering of, like, realities and, like, the real things that happened on the ship and the real people, but also just that now you're all in this together and the whole class system is out the window. And it's quite... Yeah. You know, sometimes it can be a little bit heavy-handed, but I think in terms of, like, a, you know, the film's purpose, like, it's quite important to keep reminding you that, you know, obviously the whole Jack and Rose thing is deliberately set to be first class and third class and all the rest of it, but then you also have all these other people kind of scattered around them that are going through this as well. I think it's quite nice. I think he does a quite a good job of kind of keeping that in the message as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And another really cool thing is on the commentary, James Cameron said that Jack and Rose surviving this is plausible because the baker did. The baker survived it. So once again, just tying that together to be like, you're not going to tell me my fictional characters couldn't survive this because someone who was here did survive it. So it's plausible.
Yeah.
Yes. So as they start to turn away from each other, Rose and the baker, you hear the ship start to creak a little bit more as it starts to make its final descent. And another voice starts just shrieking at this moment. And you see Rose clutching on to the railing, like, a little bit tighter like this. And then, like, this anonymous hand from someone else reaches up and grabs onto a railing. And the score starts to pick up. It goes into what I have highlighted as my most childhood nostalgia for some reason from this movie as well. This is why I love this scene. I don't know why. Like, this whole thing from Rose looking at the baker to the screaming to the clutching tighter to the score ramping up, like, all of this build up just gives me chills every time because, like, this is it. This is about to be the sinking moment, and when this score kicks in.
This is it!
Can you imagine this film without the score?
No.
Yeah.
Like, it's just...
Yeah.
Genius. James Horner. What an absolute genius.
It's not just the score, though, for me there. It's the score paired with this side shot of the ship going down right under the water right there. Like, when it's just level with the water, sort of, the camera, and you see the ship just going down right there, and there's, like, pressure bursting, windows off and, you know, open. As the score is right, and you hear all the creaking, and it's right after, because what also just puts it over for me too is, so you hear that little first horn line, and then Jack, this is it, all of this building together. I don't know why I have so much childhood nostalgia for just this, and, like, that shot of it sinking from the side shot, I don't know. But for some reason, that just gives me the most memories of watching my VHS tape. I don't know why. Maybe I watched The Sinking a lot as a kid or something, and I didn't realize that.
It's so visually impressive. Like, it just... I mean, you know, I didn't see this film until, you know, several years after its release, but there is so many shots that are breathtaking. And I know, like... It's funny that whenever I talk about Titanic, it just sounds like I can't say anything but hyperbole. But, like, there are so many parts of it that are just genuinely stunning. And that's why, you know, you're saying about nostalgia, like, those shots of it on the side are, it just looks like a ship is sinking. And I think that's the, you know, that's the thing in the whole of this film is that there are very few moments. Yes, there are some creaky bits, but the majority of the film just feels like you are watching this actually happen. I don't know, it's quite impressive that you can pull off something like that 27, 30 years ago when they were actually making it, and it still basically looked like you've just put some people on the ship and sunk it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, and you get again, like, in that bit that you're talking about, you get again that really great shot where the camera kind of like pans from below and follows them up until you're basically like riding on top with them. And it's like, again, you get that, like, you're not watching this, like, you are there with them. And again, if you see this in like IMAX 3D or something, you are not a passive viewer. Like, you are climbing on there with them. And it's just genius.
And that's the beauty of cinema just in general. I mean, there are a lot of movies that try to do the documentary approach where they do like verite and they try to make it look realistic. But I think what's beautiful about a great movie is they can have it be fictional and feel like it's really happening without having to actually have it happen. And
yeah,
that's one of the things that makes movies so magical to me, is that
I was going to say literally movie magic.
People throw that around all the time, right? But you can simulate what it would feel like if this actually happened, even though, you know, if you think about it consciously, you know, you're watching people who played pretend and put this on for you. But when you're immersed in the viewing experience, there's no difference between this and like watching it like an actual found footage or a documentary of the same thing. And to me, that's why one of the main reasons I love movies, a good movie, is for that reason.
And I think, again, this is like, I know it's been said a million times and you'll have said it a million times in this podcast, but Titanic is made for the big screen. And when you see it in a cinema, it is like just blows you away.
Certainly.
And to your point there, Pablo, when you were saying, you know, that you're with them there, I think their lines that they get during this moment, you know, of Rose just saying like, oh God, like whatever, like that adds to the anxiety for me. You know what I mean? Because they have been our eyes and ears the whole time. So when you have Rose exclaiming all of this and Jack's just, you know, still telling her to hold on, whatever, as they're facing these final moments, you know, you are there with them. And I mean, it goes along with, you know, how we've always said that you experience Titanic when you watch it. And that's what I mean here. It's like you literally, just as I was taking my notes, I said, this is experiencing Titanic. I am getting chills in between pausing to take my notes. I was watching it on my little tube TV, with my little DVD. I would be watching it, getting chills. I'd pause. I'd take some notes. I'd press play again, immediately get chills again, pause, take my notes. It's just amazing. So yeah, again, to your point, to be of it being, you know, meant to be in the cinema. Like, I'm getting chills watching it on my tiny little tube TV. It's like, yeah, in the cinema, it's totally different.
This doesn't, at no point does Titanic feel self-indulgent.
It's that earnestness.
It all feels necessary. You have to see everything.
It's funny because that all wraps up in what you were just saying there about Jack and Rose saying Michael Gordon stuff. The dialogue is, it feels to me very natural. Again, people have criticized it, but if you were on a ship doing that, you probably would just be like, oh God, like what is happening? Like, you would not be having like an intellectual conversation about the intricate details of, you know, you would just be.
And you probably wouldn't be silent either. Like, what do you want them to say?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think it all ties into that kind of, for me, like the kind of very realism of this particular scene and these shots. Did we do the bit already where the guy hits the
that's the very next thing,
because I was gonna say, I bet you know that this is always in the trailer. They absolutely love using this bit in the trailer.
Really?
And it always coincides with like Titanic, like out 6th of April or whatever, like every time.
Yeah, they do always use it in the trailers and I'm always like, why? Every time.
I kind of go through phases, like when I first saw it, because they did it for the 2012 trailer and it kind of like coincided with the title coming up, and I was like a mixture of like, is that tasteful? Yeah. But then it is very impactful, and I do think, again, when you're talking about the chaos and the violence of that night, something that probably did happen, like people would have been clinging on to anything they could find, and the chances, you know, it's quite hard to hold your own body weight, so chances are someone probably did experience something like that.
No, I mean, totally, but I think you can kind of see the shape of his body is a very CGI body shape when he falls and hits it too. It's kind of like perfectly, like it's just like perfectly like the way the body falls. So I think that's just another thing that kind of makes it stand out to me a little more, where I'm like, I wish he didn't have that there. Yes, so we get like the back shot of the propellers going down into the water as well.
Amazing as well.
Mm-hmm. Some people still bobbing in the water there. Shots of passengers clinging to the railing and still falling as it's going down. And I said, you can tell one of them is a little boy. I think like he's like holding on. There's a guy underneath him who's like kind of spinning around, like trying to get his bearings, and he loses his hat. Like his hat falls off, and just little details like that that you just notice sometimes.
To still be wearing a hat at this point is wild, by the way.
So now we get Jack being Mr. I know what to do on a sinking ship, Dawson, where this is like what people have criticized of being like, oh, he knows exactly what to tell Rose because he just has survived so many sinking ships or something, I guess. I don't know. He's just an expert.
You never know.
So he tells her, the ship is going to suck us down. Take a deep breath when I say, kick for the surface and keep kicking. Do not let go of my hand. Obviously, spaced out. He's not just telling her all of this. But exactly. And then we're going to make it, Rose. Trust me. And she says, I trust you, which this is another callback to the flying scene, the trust that she had put in him in that moment. Now she's like literally putting her life in his hands and saying, I trust you. But yeah, but this is, you know, would she even be able to hear him like screaming over all of this going on in this moment? I feel like Jack would have to be yelling way louder than Leo is in this scene.
Yeah, I would have lost my voice already.
Yeah. So I said like, oh yeah, like all the bubbling water and everything looks so great with this model that they're using here going under. I just think it looks really great. You can tell that some of the people disappearing into the water are motion capture, but like in the moment, you don't notice or care. You're focused on Jack and Rose in the foreground shots every time we see them from above. You're mainly paying attention to them and just like the water bubbling like crazy. You're not really paying attention to the little people who are getting like sucked under. We get that back shot again there of just Titanic, Liverpool, you know, right as it's about to go under.
That shot is so epic.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's just so, like, it really is like the final bit, and it's just so impactful. It's one of those things I always remember, is just that kind of seeing the name of the ship just, and then it's gone.
And you would think that they just designed it this way for the sake of the movie. It's like, no, but like it said it on the back. Like that's where it's at. Like if it went down, that is the last thing you would have seen. Like one of the last things you would have seen would be the name.
Yeah.
So that's just crazy. Of course, Jack, ready now. They take that breath. And every single time I'm like, did they maybe take it just a little too early?
Yes. I am so glad you said this. Oh my God. This is honestly like, this is like my dream come true, because I never get to talk to anyone about like tiny, I mean, I don't get to talk to anyone about Titanic, but I have always, always thought this. It feels like you did that too early. And I'm like, wait, hold on. Because if you, I mean, I'm sure you've tried this. If you try and hold your breath with them, it's really hard because they do it too early. They do it too early. I love this film, but they do it too early.
I thought maybe the logic was if you do it slightly too late, even though you're not underwater yet, it might be splashing and like make it harder. That's what I was thinking. But yeah, it is still really, really early. Because yeah, on the other hand, if they would have done it later, I might have been like, oh, but they'd been splashing in their throat and it would have been harder to hold their breath. So I don't know. But yeah, it is early though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I always do that. Every time I've seen it in the movies, I try to hold my breath along with them in that moment. And it's really hard after they go under. The frigid cold water.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way you know which way is up.
Your muscles are clenching on top of it, yeah.
There's no way I could hold my breath. But that's why it's like maybe you just think if only they could have gotten at least 3 extra seconds there or something. You know,
and every second would have counted. Like in that moment, every second counts. If you're going to be Jack and you know like what to do, like hold your breath and do this and kick for the surface, like you ought to know that a couple of extra seconds makes all the difference, you know? There's a really good, like the groaning of the ship in as it goes under as well is really, really loud. If you see it in the cinema, it's like almost deafening, this kind of like the final just...
The rumble.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Obviously, like I always notice when Jack sort of stands up right before it goes under, like the baker gets up a little bit too.
He apparently did that. He apparently literally stepped off the ship.
Stepped off just, it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said that he like didn't even get his head wet, he claimed. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I also said I love how, I think it's the flagpole, right? That's the very last thing to go under. And it does a little bloop. That is like, ah. Because I know it was a model that they sank and, you know, made it look like it's out in the ocean and put them on it and stuff, I guess. But just that one little detail of even the flagpole getting its little moment and its little baby splash. I'm just like, it just looks so much realer. Like, it looks so real.
All of those little details, or like visual things like that, but also things like, you know, when you see like the flying scene and you get like all these close-ups to the bow and you see the kind of like tiny little bits of rust and like the detail on the ship. I had never seen those properly before until I saw it on 4K. And when you see it in 4K, you see all that detail and you're just like, holy moly. Like, he really went to so much detail in the original filming that would not be seen for like 25 years. Because if you're watching it on VHS, you can't see all those little bits.
No.
And now I watch it and I think, it's partly why this film stands the test of time, because you're not, when you see the flying scene, you're seeing like the side of the ship. You're not just seeing like a pristine, clean ship. Like, he has gone to the detail of like being a little bit of rust here and like a little bit of like indentation there. And like all those things, like he's saying with the flagpole there, like it's not just, it goes down and that's it. Like, every single thing has been thought about. And so when you see it in 4K 3D or on 4K at home, all of that detail is there. And it's like, you realize just how far, like, all the details that James Cameron went to. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, so with that, Titanic is gone. And that is a crazy moment to just happen on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys have been building to this for a while.
Yep. It's insane. I cannot believe that Titanic is gone on this podcast right now. It is under the ocean for good, on its way down. And yeah, so that is the very next shot we see of Jack and Rose trying to kick to the surface, trying to get their bearings underwater, figure out which way's up. And you see that shot of the ship green screened in behind them, of just Titanic, the name, like going down. And James Cameron says that he thinks they might have amped up the suction a little too much, that there wouldn't have been this much suction, which, I mean, interesting to me. I mean, that ship was pretty huge and pretty heavy, so, I mean, I don't really know how that works, but...
You know, the funny thing about that is that I always thought, so particularly when I started to know more about the ship, and when I worked at Titanic Belfast, we had this brilliant gallery where you have this, like, huge glass floor, and you can stand on this glass floor and the whole wreck of Titanic would go beneath you. So they like basically went down and took millions of photographs of Titanic and like stitched it all together. And one of the things that's always really interesting is obviously the difference between the bow and the stern, like completely different conditions. And the stern, as it went down, because the water basically forced all the air to the back, the stern basically like flipped open almost like a can. Like, if you imagine like you're opening like a can. So it's funny that when I heard James Cameron say that, I was like, but in my mind, like, the amount of air and like the destruction that happened to the stern probably would, I mean, I am not a scientist, James Cameron will know more than me, but like, it didn't seem that implausible. Like, I remember seeing it, and then when I put it all together, I was like, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of air and a lot of suction, and I don't know. But then, as they say, like, the baker said he just stepped off and didn't even get his hair wet. So I'm never sure quite how all of those things match up.
I don't know. But I'm sure like the historians had said like, but who knows, you know, he was so drunk, maybe he just had no recollection. You know, he maybe, you know, he's not remembering correctly, you know, who knows. But yes, so Jack and Rose are trying to keep a hold of each other, but the suction is real in the movie here. And it's almost impossible. There's no, like I said, there's no way you could know which way's up. And especially in actuality, it would just be pitch black under the ocean. They can't see each other as well as they can in the movie. And, you know, opening their eyes underwater in the frigid cold, which we...
Oh, it'd be so cold. Yeah.
Which I think we talked about earlier when Jack was like going underwater to try to get the keys and whatever. Yeah. I never even thought about the fact that him opening his eyes in water that cold would really hurt his eyes. So Yeah, and then like the sound design is illustrating the suction pulling them apart as well. Rose is, you know, reaching out her hand, but Jack's just gone now at this point. She, you know, so they're still holding their breath, which is crazy because if you try to do it, it is a long time.
They have adrenaline on their side, though.
I guess if your life depended on it, you could probably.
Yeah.
this is not like you're sitting in the cinema. Like, if your life really depended on it, you could probably squeeze a few extra seconds.
Probably.
Yeah.
But I mean, trying to find your balance and whatever, all that on top of it, the frigid cold, I would imagine it'd be very difficult. Rose surfaces with a giant deep breath and begins screaming for Jack, and we can hear her clearly because it's, you know, focused in on her. And then it starts to zoom out and reveal more and more of this sea of people, this, you know, the sea of passengers who have just been abandoned.
Great shot.
By the Titanic.
No, I'm saying cinematically, even though they lose each other here in this moment, it's actually a fairly hopeful moment for Jack and Rose, because you know that he's not gone yet, because it's too unceremonious for him to have just died this way. Mm-hmm. So it's actually like a little trick that, like, I think filmmakers use sometimes, whereas like they give you a false sense of defeat. So that way, like, when they come together after it, your brain is like, oh, okay, so they're both going to survive. So it kind of makes you even more sure that your characters are going to survive. So when one of them does die, it like brings you down even further, because you're like, wait, we just lost them and then they came back together. It's like this subconscious thing that filmmakers do sometimes. But in this moment, it felt very hopeful because of the fact we know they're going to get back together at some point.
So many other people had still somehow survived and are in the water, you know?
That too.
But I will say, though, I just love the sound editing of how, like I said, when it's tight on Rose, we can hear her perfectly, obviously, but as it zooms out, her voice becomes fainter and fainter and fainter and just blends in with everyone else. And you just think, how is anyone going to hear her?
Everyone's screaming something. Yeah.
Everyone is screaming for someone.
I'm not sure if it's before or after the camera pulls out, but there is also an amazing point of view shot where you see it as Rose and she's like shouting for Jack. And you flip from seeing Rose to then her point of view. And it is horrifying.
Yeah.
Well, then, because you're at the level, right? So you've basically water up to your mouth or your chin. And so the camera is right there and you just suddenly, it's a slightly different feeling to just, oh, right, she's in the water, it's really cold. And like, you have that gasp, which I always, I don't know, feel for some reason. I'm like, oh, God, like the gasp is so sort of visceral. But then you get that shot where you're like, oh, my God, this water is like up to her chin. And she can't, like, she's not seeing it the way we are. She is just seeing black and a lot of people and a lot of commotion. And that's it. And what you were just saying about the sound design, when you see it in a cinema and you have the surround sound, the screaming around you is actually horrible. Like, it's really, I remember noticing it for the first time when I saw it in the cinema, and the surround sound, the screams in those moments is just horrifying.
Because they have them coming out of like different things. Like you hear someone and it sounds like they're screaming like behind you.
They're right there. Yeah.
I used to think that people were screaming in the theater. Like, I was like, what? Like, and then I was like, oh my gosh, no, like I'm there. Like, they're putting me there with the sound right now.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird, right? Because you're like talking about people screaming, but it is like, in terms of like immersive cinema, it's like, you know, top tier.
No, and I'm pretty sure like what you're talking about when it cuts to Rose's, you know, point of view, I feel like when they show that, because like, again, you hear everyone screaming, it's just chaos, water splashing. And I think it even like you can see her looking at someone who's already dead, it looked like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It looked like someone just floating in a life vest, like by her, who's like already gone. At least that's what I've always thought.
Those few moments, like in the water there and the pulling out, is just so, again, what I was saying before about kind of really capturing just the horror of that night. I just think it does so perfectly. And it's, again, it's kind of weird to be talking about sort of like this sort of so cinematically and so like forensically, but it really, like, those moments are just almost what cinema is for, right? It just moves you in a way that you just
yeah.
couldn't imagine. And no documentary, no interview with anyone could capture that moment.
Exactly.
And, you know, the sounds and what you're seeing, it's just like, just chilling. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, yeah, how will they ever find each other again, though? Is how you do feel, though, when you see this giant sea of people. But
I think this is it
for the best. End of movie. Credits.
So I would, I guess, just like to wrap up this part as well with a line that I've read on this podcast before, but now it's really relevant, which is the last paragraph of Roger Ebert's review of Titanic. He said, "The image from Titanic that has haunted me ever since I first read the story of the great ship involves the moments right after it sank. The night sea was quiet enough so that the cries for help easily carried across the water to the lifeboats, which drew prudently away. Still dressed up in the latest fashions, hundreds froze and drowned. What an extraordinary position to find yourself in after spending all that money for a ticket on an unsinkable ship." And I feel like that's almost part of the intention behind that shot as well, you know?
Yeah, you pay money for something that literally floats and takes you from point A to point B, and now you're sinking and you're in one spot and you can't go anywhere.
I've just realized, I feel like, did we miss, I'm just looking at the notes that I made, did we miss the toilet paper shot?
Oh, I was gonna mention that.
Because I think it's quite impressive, like because you kind of start at the top and then you, mm-hmm. it like pans all the way down, you see this guy kind of like falling. So it's called the toilet paper shot because they, I don't know why they used toilet paper, but they just threw toilet paper up and then someone dropped it like on set and then they replaced the toilet paper with a guy falling.
I don't know.
I don't know why they used toilet paper. I
had that written down to be like, toilet paper shot? Should I mention it? But yeah,
it's less the guy. I think it's more just like you have this great pan shot of like right from the top all the way down as the ship's standing vertical, and you kind of get this sort of sense of how like you're kind of doing this, like you're looking down with it. It's quite yeah. disorientating to some degree.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that part is illustrating how high it is yeah. as well. Yeah, and then, you know, so you see this guy fall all the way down. And his the scream that they have that character make, too, sounds very like a stock scream sometimes to be a little bit. And they make it so that, like, as he falls closer to the camera, it's louder, and then it's a little bit more quiet mm-hmm. as he falls further away. But, yeah, that is referencing something earlier in the scene.
Yeah, sorry.
I kind of like keeping that at the end as we were like, wait a minute. The toilet paper shot? Yes. Did we talk about
it's
this?
Because I was, well, I just thought, what if someone's listening and they're like, those traitors, like, they say they know the film and they're not mentioning the toilet paper shot. Yeah. Like, we might have a boycott on our hands if we don't mention it.
We kept them waiting until
exactly. That was, yeah. If you just cut out all of this chat and we'll just pretend that, like, we were just leading up to, and now, guys,
the toilet paper shot. We did not forget. But yeah, so that is the end of the scene. Amazingly, got through all my notes, all 6.5 pages, which I didn't know if we were. Yeah, so thank you, Pablo, so much for coming on. I hope you had a good time discussing this with us.
I just love talking about Titanic. So I don't know if you can
tell. This is great. Yeah.
It's such a relief. No one, like, I don't have anyone in my immediate life who I can do this with. So every now and again, I just, like, message, like, you or, like, LA, and I'm like, so, I just need to get it off my chest because no one will talk to me about Titanic, and I've just got to get it out.
And I was going to say, I did see you went on LA's podcast recently, right? I still haven't checked that out yet, but I did see it, and I was like, oh.
Yeah, we did one all about the kind of, ironically, sort of commercialization of Titanic because... Mm-hmm. Like I talk a lot about like lifting things from the wreck and that sort of stuff. Mm. And it was relevant because Titanic Belfast had a very, very strict, like, nothing from the wreck policy. So they have stuff from the ship that maybe like passengers took off before it sank, but anything that went down to the seabed, they didn't take. But James Cameron's like Titanic comes up a lot in that because obviously it's like a central part of the sort of commercialization and sort of legacy of Titanic.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah, I'll have to check it out. So shout out to that episode of Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast with LA, who has come on our pod before, and we might have her on again, I think, maybe. I don't know. We definitely wanted to reach out to her again before we're done here, which is crazy. Gosh, can't believe.
It's so close.
I know. I cannot believe that this is, we're in epilogue territory now. Like, now the Titanic is gone. Like, this is the aftermath of the sinking, you know, all these other.
You've still got the debate about.
We still got that. That's next.
The debate. It's not a debate in my book.
Is that the next scene?
That's the next scene.
Okay. Exciting for that 4-hour podcast.
I was going to say, you need to carve some time for that one.
Because I feel like, you know, we all call it, quote unquote, the door debate, but we know, those of us who know, we know it's not a door. But that's just the easy thing to call it.
It was a piece of toilet paper, right?
that they replaced.
You can see the quote-unquote door in a museum in Nova Scotia, in Halifax. They actually have, not from the film, sorry, they have the actual the wood paneling from the wreck that James Cameron based. This is the funny thing, is that everyone goes, oh, it's so inaccurate, like, two people could... Well, actually, James Cameron based it on a real piece, so shush.
Yes.
Like, it's cool. A real thing. Like, he's not just made up a piece of wood. But yeah, you can see it in...
This is the Halifax location? Okay.
Yeah, cool. They have like it's the Maritime Museum of Halifax, Nova Scotia. They have like a kind of, I think they have like a small Titanic exhibition. And one of the things is that piece of wood from the wreck.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I always feel really bad. Like whenever I've seen James Cameron do those documentaries, like, you know, myth busting that scene, I just think the poor guy, like, went to extreme lengths to like base it on a real thing, and people still aren't happy about it. It was like, it's a real thing.
He'll never get past it. Yeah, he'll never overcome this.
Oh goodness, but yeah. So I was thinking, I don't know if we should have a guest on for that one. I think it should just be me and Ethan.
Yeah, that could get long.
Keep it classic for the the door debate. Just.
But you don't have a ton after that, because you have the sort of Jack's death, and then you've got all the kind of sort of modern day stuff. But then you're pretty much at the dream sequence.
Yeah.
Which is, are you going to have someone on for the credits?
And what about the post-credit scene where they tease the sequel?
The one that no one saw until like now, because...
Yeah. Which, breaking news, guys. If you stay till the end, there's like a Marvel-style like clip at the very...
It turns out that the Heart of the Ocean is actually one of the Infinity Stones, and then that's...
That's why. That, to be fair, that Titanic 2 trailer, when I first saw it, I could not... Like, I mean, I saw it a long time ago. Like, back when the internet was just, like, YouTube had just begun. I didn't get it. Like, I kind of thought it was real. I didn't, because I hadn't seen all of Leonardo DiCaprio's other films. So I was like, what? Like, is this happening? And because it doesn't specify, it's like, this summer, Jack. And I was like, wait, what summer? This, like, it's summer right now, because I saw it. And like, so I was like, what's happening? And I was like, really, like, panicking. I was like, wait, how did I miss that, like, my favorite film has got a sequel?
I love that. This summer. Wait, what summer?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's a ride. You should do a scene by scene of that.
Of just the trailer.
Yeah.
So the good. Spoof trailer. Oh man, I watched it again the other night. It's pretty good. I don't know if you.
I don't think I think I've just seen like people referencing it.
It's
I don't
really think I've watched funny. It. It's really
there
funny.
Are loads now though. When you search YouTube, like, there are tons of like remakes, but, like, the original one. With like the My Heart Will Go On like remix in there.
A remix?
Yeah, they have like a remix to My Heart Will Go On.
House 90s house remix kinda.
This summer, Jack's back.
So, as he's like running around the city.
I remember, like, do you guys have Shazam here?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was like Shazamming that. Like, it's really good.
I just him being preserved in that perfect block of ice just gets me every time.
It's so good. There's also like the scene, for some reason there's a brilliant shot where they've like edited Leo's face in a computer screen, and then it's him googling, just he goes on Google and types in Rose DeWitt Bugator. Which I guess you would do, right? Like, if you were... But you'd have to know what Google... You'd have to know what a computer and Google is, which they obviously didn't have in 1912. So he wakes up and is like, I'm going to just Google Rose and see what happens.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. It's so good. Oh, someone had a lot of fun with that. Someone had a lot of fun with that.
Oh, it's funny. But yes, so thank you so much, Pablo, for coming on today. Had a blast speaking with you. So nice to meet digitally, but still face-to-face, kind of. And yeah, so is there anything you want to shout out or plug or any socials people can find you on?
Well, people can find me on... I'm most active kind of on Instagram. There's just basically Endless Titanic and... I mean, I'm Titanic wherever I go. I tried to keep Titanic in. When they re-released Titanic earlier in 2023, I was like, right, I'm going to set up a TikTok, which I don't have, and just post Titanic, just like get it all out of my system. It didn't work. All that happened is I post about Titanic on TikTok and on Instagram and on Twitter. So it's... take your pick, and I'll be there talking about Titanic.
Love it. But yeah, so once again, just thank you for coming on. Had a blast.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was awesome. So thank you all for listening. As always, we really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on all the socials for updates and whatnot. All the links will be in the description. Pablo, I'll put all your stuff down there too. Send us an email, titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Leave a voice message or email us a voice note or memo, whatever you want to do. Follow us on Letterboxd, me and Ethan. Both of our links will be in the show notes. And wow, yeah, with that, Titanic is gone on this podcast, and we will see you in the next scene, which is the infamous debate of all debates, which is not going to be a debate for us, really, I don't think, but we will be squashing certain things people have to say about it, I guess, maybe. And we will see you then in the next scene.